This week on the BOAG World Show, we talk about working in teams, dealing with stress, and fighting for the needs of users. This week's show is sponsored by Full Story and Resource Guru. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG and joining me in person this week is Marcus Lillington.
How weird.
Stop! We don't have time for waffle on this show. You're not allowed to say anything, Marcus.
We've got to fit three in.
We've got to fit three in. This is so exciting.
Okay, well, straight on to the first one then.
No, there's certain things that need to be covered. For a start, people need to know that they can still submit talks. Now we're getting three into every show. So they can submit talk by going to boag.world/season18. Obviously, normally, subtly in the waffle at the beginning of the show, I would promote my upcoming workshop, but we don't have time for that.
You've got to be unsubtle about it.
So boag.world/convince. Normally, maybe I'd slip in a promotion for my book because, you know, you do. So that's boag.world/UX-book. So there.
Okay.
Kind of rips a heart out of the show, doesn't it?
I don't know what to say now. I'm going on holiday.
Right. Yeah, we've done that. That's an obligatory part you seem to say every week.
Yeah. Well, because you've got Andy on next week.
Yeah, so we can talk about Australia for 30 seconds. But that's really all we have time for. So let's get on to our first talk. Should we really do that?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So the first one is from Chris Myhill. And he's going to be talking about the designer's job and how our job is to guide the decision-making process. So if we want to be, to have good projects that run smoothly, how we need to involve other people in the design process and how we go about doing that as designers. So over to Chris.
A lot of people think about design in terms of pixel pushing, and that's a misconception that really grinds my gears. Producing mock-ups is a big part of the job, sure, but that's just the end result. A designer's actual job is to guide a decision-making process, and to inform these decisions, we need to use research findings, inputs from our team, and an understanding of project objectives. These different things all feed into the stuff we make, be they wireframes, prototypes, diagrams, or anything else, really. I've worked with a lot of designers, and I've come to realise that the ability to work with people is far more important than any technical proficiency or artistic flair. Good designers can't operate in a vacuum, and this is because our job is to solve other people's problems. The problems of our users, of course, but also the problems of our teams and our clients. There are three key qualities that I feel any good designer needs to have. They need to have leadership ability so that they can push teams towards decisions. They need to have empathy so that they can accommodate the goals of their various team members, and these can sometimes go at odds with their own personal views. And above all, they need diplomacy. When I studied human-computer interaction at university, I learnt an awful lot about design best practice, and this was from the work of Jacob Nielsen, Don Norman, and the like. A note for our younger listeners, human-computer interaction was the far less sexy name for what then was UX, and just saying that makes me feel like a crumbly old dinosaur. Anyway, I came into my first job prepared with all of the know-how to be an awesome web designer, or so I thought. But what I wasn't at all prepared for was working with real teams. I still remember the first time that a client I was working with utterly hated my design work. And despite conducting all the right research and using all the right best practices, they just wouldn't approve these designs, and I couldn't get my head around it. It was so frustrating. Why could this idiot not see that I was the expert, and they were paying me for my advice, so why weren't they taking it? When this kept happening, I started to realise that maybe I was the problem. Perhaps there was a little bit more to this job than just producing what I thought was the right design for the user. I'd been so wrapped up in being a know-it-all that I'd neglected to think about what the other people on my team thought. What issues were they grappling with? For example, let's focus on our clients. It's not surprising that every client has their own objectives on a project. They're generally being put under a lot of pressure by their own bosses or their shareholders. It's their neck on the line the project goes tits up. It's through our designs that a client is going to either meet or fail their objectives, so it's only natural that they're going to be anxious to give their input. It's like this with the rest of the team too. Everyone has their own individual goals on a project, and that's going to be what's at the forefront of their minds when looking at your designs. The developers, for instance, might really be prioritizing performance, making the website super fast. The marketing guys and gals, they might want to make sure we're accommodating the campaigns and promotions that they're going to be running, and so on. Everyone on a team has their own goals. So how can we work with them more effectively? Well, I find the key to success is to get everybody involved early. I like to start any big project with a discovery workshop, and these are generally quite hefty sessions, and they can take half a day, even a full day. There's a lot of good reasons to do this, though, because a big portion of that workshop's always dedicated to understanding the team's objectives. That's why everybody needs to come along to this. The designer, the developer, the client. We want someone to represent each person that's going to be on the project. When we start, I ask for a brain dump of everything everybody wants to achieve through this bit of work. We then work through and prioritize all of these different goals as a team. This gives me a feel for what everyone's aligned on and what's really important for the project. Doing this is valuable for a few reasons. The most obvious is that it guides decisions in the design, but beyond that, it also helps build a team relationship. Going through this activity puts the team at ease. It shows them I'm listening and I'm fully prepared to take their views on board in the design. It also highlights any potential conflicts early. If people don't agree on objectives, it's best to get these debates out of the way now before we waste time doing any work that might not be quite right. Once I've got all of this knowledge of everyone's goals, I can also then revisit them in future presentations. When I'm sharing deliverables like wireframes for the first time, I can call back to the things we discussed in the discovery workshop, and it makes the whole team feel more at ease that I'm thinking about their needs. It makes them feel more confident in what I'm doing. A little warning about these workshops. Although technology has come a long way and it has helped make remote workshops possible, I find that these kinds of sessions are way more effective when you do them face to face. With everyone there in the same room, I found that people were just a lot more comfortable sharing ideas. And it also means that I'm able to pick up when someone pulls a face in reaction to a point, but isn't confident enough to actually speak out. Beyond that first workshop, it's good to keep the whole team involved as early as you can. In the early days of my career, I'd always treated clients as a gatekeeper for the design work. They'd be involved at a series of key dates that we'd decide upon well in advance. We'd put these dates on a big Gantt chart or some equally horrifying looking project plan, and then all count down to the dreaded moment where we'd actually have to share the design work. Those presentations would be a ridiculously formal affair. I'd put on smart shoes and wear a shirt for some reason, and we'd put the designs on a big screen or a projector or, in the really early days, even mounted on a board or a printout. And this was when there was only just two or three of us in the room. I'd take the feedback from those presentations on board and disappear for a week to work on something else. This cycle would repeat until we'd either signed off the design or we'd all killed ourselves due to the tedium. I realised that this focus on big formal presentations might be why my relationships with clients was so naff. By waiting for these big milestones before sharing anything, I could spend far too much time going down the rabbit hole, working up ideas that weren't aligned to the team's needs. This way of working wasted my time, and it wasted the client's money. It was a lose-lose situation. By only having interaction with my wider team during these really formal presentations, it also meant that I could never really build a rapport with them. Meetings always felt very business-like, which didn't help when it came to sharing feedback and getting honest opinions. I'm trying to do my best to change this. Nowadays, whenever possible, I encourage a more collaborative way of working. Rather than waiting for presentation dates before sharing designs with the team, I try to drip feed everyone little ideas and little snippets. This can be as simple as firing over an email every now and again, or requesting impromptu 15-minute meetings. If they can't get there in person, then just do a screen share asking for feedback on a specific thing. Not only does it encourage collaboration, but it also means that nobody's going to be shocked when we do present the full deliverable. It becomes a formality rather than a big deal. If that isn't enough, instant messengers like Slack and Fleep can be a good shout too. I found this to be a little too progressive for some clients, and letting your client in on the banter that happens on Slack can be dangerous sometimes, but for the right projects, it can be a godsend. And if all else fails, just try and get the whole team together, including the client, to work together in the same space once every few days or so. Even if you're not actually there for a pre-arranged meeting or to discuss anything specific, it gives those precious opportunities for impromptu catch-ups and just relationship building. One last thing. When sharing design work with your team, don't try and bamboozle everyone with UX bullshit. I do my very best to communicate in plain English and drop all the impressive-sounding industry terms. Nobody's impressed with your heuristic evaluations or with the size of your contextual inquiry. Your team just want to know what you're doing to solve their problems. If there's one thing I'd like designers to take away from this whole spiel, it's that you should try and leave your ego at the door. Design, by definition, is decision-making. It's making the calls that allow a product to meet its objectives. And to that end, basically anyone can be a designer. I've worked on loads of projects where the people in my team, without any kind of design training, have provided incredible insights that have actually affected the final results in a really positive way. If you'd like to learn more about building better relationships with your teams, I'd strongly suggest Mike Montero's writing. His book Design is a Job and the follow-up You're My Favorite Client are just fantastic reads. I've also heard that Paul Boag bloke might have written a few things about this too. I don't know. Maybe check him out too if you can be bothered. If you'd like to learn more about me and what I'm up to, I blog at justuxdesign.com and occasionally use the Twitter, where you can find me at justuxdesign. Cheers.
All right, so that was Chris. Very good. Do we have time to talk about him? Well, not about him, because that would be rude to talk about someone behind their backs.
No, if you say nice things, though,
that
would be all right.
And is it behind his back if I'm broadcasting it publicly? Probably not. He's got very nice hair in his picture. I'm quite envious of his hair.
Has he?
Yeah.
Well, he's just got sort of quite a young man's hair.
He's got hair. That's why I'm envious.
Because it's not like my hair. My hair that used to be dark brown is now more sort of... I have highlights in it. Well,
your hair at the moment is looking quite interesting because your headphones are pushing it up. So it's like this kind of sprout from the top of your head.
Crazy hair, man.
Yeah. So no, I thought it was good talk.
It was.
What? You're allowed to have 3 points about his talk. That's all we've got time for, Marcus.
Okay, well, obviously, whilst banging my own drum, I have to agree with him that empathy is really important empathy is really important for success in pretty much everything we do.
Why are you saying that's for banging your own drum?
Overlooked. Well, I think I'm quite an empathetic person.
You're a pathetic person.
Setting us up for that
sorry,
one, didn't I?
Sorry. How could I not?
You have even said that in the past.
You are. It is your strength, I would say.
I always try and find the best and find the best path.
It's not even finding the best in someone as much as just associating with how they're feeling. Mm. And designers, we're really good at, we say that all the time about, we do it with users. Oh, yes, put yourself in the user's shoes. Mm. Nobody ever bothers to do it with their teammates. Mm. You know, as soon as somebody disagrees with you over something, your initial reaction is,
yeah.
while we should be empathizing with them and what they're struggling with, because clients in particular, I mean, this is the thing I liked in Chris's talk, was, you know, clients in particular face very real fears working on projects. You know, their jobs
are on the line.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Often. Yeah.
So I think it's really important to empathize with them and what they're going through, because it's a shit job. And just because we've built websites 100 times doesn't mean that they have and that they understand the process. And you know, you need to hold their hands through it.
Yeah. I think he had 3 points, which were leadership, empathy and diplomacy.
Yes.
And what things that designers need or people that work in our industry need.
Yeah.
And leadership is the one that's lacking the most, I think. I think it's because people don't want that. Like, they don't want to be leaders. They don't want to sort of guide the process.
Mm.
And that's a hard one to expect of people, I think.
Also, I think there's it's a very easy one to get wrong.
Yeah.
Leadership. Because leadership leadership is not always leading from above, right? Often, I think good leadership is from below, where effectively you're asking the dumb question. You're prodding
putting
and nudging people in the right direction, but you're not dictating it. You know, a leader is not a dictator. And so I think that's partly why a lot of people fear it, because they don't want to be that person. Then a lot of people end up becoming that person.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not the way to do with it. You know, I think of it, good leadership is facilitation. That sounds so pretentious. But it is.
You've been selling your consultancy services lately.
I have, yeah. yes. But also, the other thing with leadership that I think a lot of people shy away from, it's making a frigging decision.
Mm.
I swear half the time people hire me just to make a decision on their behalf.
Well, yeah, that's what it comes back to, this idea of it's scary, your job's on the line.
Mm.
So if you can hire somebody to help
you
with
that, shift their blame onto it. Yeah,
exactly. And I was about to say something very kind of broad and sweeping and say that every client we've ever worked with has hired us for that reason. That's not true, but a lot of them have. They want that kind of helping hand or kick up the bum or whatever. I don't know, but helping up.
The other thing I liked about is his emphasis on face-to-face workshops and how important they are. That for me is a really big thing.
Yeah, I wrote that.
Getting actually in front of and engaging with people, I think, is so important.
Yeah, and he also said that the whole team needs to be part of that. And I couldn't agree more. Because, as you know, Paul, we work in the States quite a bit.
Yeah.
And the whole team goes out. And
which is expensive.
It's expensive, and often for maybe the developer, because what we're doing is kind of UX stuff.
Yeah.
You know, talking about aesthetics. And
yeah.
They're just sat there kind of twiddling their thumbs. They're not twiddling their thumbs, but, you know, it's just absorbing all of the stuff.
It would be very easy to conclude, oh, we don't need the developer in the room.
Yeah.
But if you don't have the developer in the room, there are two consequences. One, some things that are said in the room will have huge development consequences. And they might only say one thing in the entire day's workshop, but that one thing could save you $20,000 of problems later down the line.
Yeah.
But secondly...
Shut up, Marcus, you idiot.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. saying that one line has saved Headscape a lot of money over the years. But also the other reason is because then they understand the project, they understand the context, they understand why decisions were made, and they were involved in that. And so they feel a sense of engagement. Mm. So I often see, and it prevents that whole thing of, you know, the developers are at the end of the chain, aren't they? Mm. You know, you need them in the room, even if that means shipping them out to America, which, to be honest, they love because they get a free away trip. So that's always good.
Yes.
You're working with a lot of American clients at the minute, aren't you?
We are.
Lucky you.
It's quite a way, you know.
Although, can you get in the country anymore?
That I went out a week after Trump was inaugurated.
Oh, right.
And there was a lot of protests going on, a hell of a lot.
Really?
Yeah, it's really weird. I was that one I went on my own as well, so I was kind of a little bit of a loose end.
Mm.
I was going to wander about.
So you just joined in a random protest,
No, I was more of a kind of like looker or honorer.
Oh, right. Okay.
From the side.
Well, there you go. Next time.
One more thing about Let's Talk is he's mentioned Mike Montero. He's my favourite speaker of them all.
Yes, you like... He is very
Mr.
good.
Mr. Angry.
Yeah, that's why he's good.
Yeah, and he's kind of... one of the talks was, I can't remember the title of the talk, but he's just written one of his books about, you know, the responsibility of designers.
Yeah.
And he's handing, I think he's got five of them to hand out, hardback copies. And he's basically just saying, no, all these guys come down the front and said, piss off, you lot. All the women come down. You get paid 70 cents in every dollar to these guys. He's a proper...
Ooh, I like that idea.
Sort of, you know, he's a bit right on, but he is right.
Yeah.
So, and the latest one, which I think I'm going to mention in reaction to one of the other talks, is about fascism.
Ooh.
Yeah. And that's worth watching.
How do any of the talks relate to fascism?
I can't remember.
But you find a way of crowbarring it in because you just want to talk about fascism.
Yeah, and Mike Monterey.
The other thing that I agreed with, just before we move on, I want to quickly mention is Chris talked about avoiding those big milestones.
Mm.
I'm a fan of this, and we've talked about this before because you kind of like sign off on certain things, or you used to. One thing, which is sign off the design, isn't it? Yeah. Well, I prefer, wherever possible, to avoid those kinds of things because they become big in the client's minds and they're less likely to do it. I can understand your side of it as well. But it is quite an interesting, that principle of avoid building things up by making it too, this is set in stone, once you sign this, things shall never change. Because actually, I just think it creates more anxiety. More anxiety leads to more micromanagement, you know, would be my response to it.
Potentially, yeah. When's mine talk on? Is it next week? Week after?
Next week.
Okay. Well, I talk about our design process and the fact that I think it's good. And we don't limit iterations on design. I think if you don't do that, which we don't, you do need to have an endpoint. I think that's kind of where it comes from.
Yeah, I can kind of.
It's not absolutely set in stone. Nothing can ever change ever again.
Yeah,
but it's kind of like now we're going to start. We're going more onto a build mentality than we are. We're on.
Yeah, and I kind of agree with that. I think the to be honest, my main reason for having some kind of sign off on design after saying that I'm not particularly keen on it is swoop and poop managers. It's being able to turn around and say, I'm sorry, but this was signed off. And so therefore, you know, you're going to have to pay if you want to change it from now on.
Yeah.
So it's not so much the client you're working with, because hopefully you've taken the client through that journey.
Exactly.
So they don't really need to sign it off. It's for other managers, other people potentially coming in later.
It's also it's saying we finished that bit. Now we're going to start doing
this bit.
Which you could argue then you need to sign off on every phase, but it is the design one that bothers me more than others.
It's interesting. I mean, I think I liked Chris's point in that, but it's, you know, it's using it all in the right way, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, let's quickly talk about our sponsors, our first sponsor, which is Resource Guru, and then we'll get on to our second talk. So Resource Guru is a fast, simple way to schedule the resources within your projects. I can see you moving around the page in our notes.
Wow.
Sorry, I'm using a new, Resource Guru. I'm going to stop promoting you, who are paying me, and instead promote another thing that I've been recently, which is I've discovered this thing called Notion... Is it SO?
Notion.so.
Yeah, Notion.so, which is like a wiki-type app thing, which we're running our show notes in. It's really good. I really like it. It's a bit like Google Docs, but not Google Docs, which is why I like it. Anyway, Resource Guru.
Mm-hmm.
So Resource Guru is a simple way to schedule your resources, dealing with project planning, which we know is really hard, scheduling changes, all of that kind of stuff. You know, and you know what happens when deadlines get moved, then your whole kind of system falls apart. And then someone turns around and says, I booked holiday. I'm sure that I agreed that with you 6 months ago. No, freaking didn't.
It's like Lee taking a month off last summer.
Did he really? He took all his holiday in one go.
It wasn't quite a month. It was 3.5 weeks.
Ooh.
And I didn't know about it.
See, you needed... Well, you guys use Resource Guru.
Yeah, we...
Badly, apparently.
I'm not sure we were using it then. We might have been. I don't know.
I don't know when you started using it either. No, I think it's since then you started using it.
Mm.
But of course, that still depends on someone like Lee putting, you know...
Look,
we know how good
Emma
Lee is at updating stuff. Yeah.
So Emma's the one who manages it.
Yeah, exactly. So, it means, in theory, if you use it, you've got the right resources available when you need them and you know what's going on, which obviously can be bad, as we learned from Headscape. Thank you for suffering through that pain to teach us all a valuable lesson. I don't know.
Okay. We managed.
So Resource Guru can help with all this kind of stuff. It's accurate, it's up to date, and gives you a view of the big picture, which is always good. Who's busy, who's not, who's available. And when things need to change, that's fine. We know that things need to change all the time when you're running an agency. And that's simply dragging and dropping things in order to update your schedule. You can also be confident that whether your projects are on track or not, because you can see all of that right in front of you. And there are loads of great companies that are using it. It's very well established within the sector. Headscape obviously use it, but then grown-up companies like Saatchi & Saatchi and Razorfish and Cisco and people like that also use it as well. You can try it yourself for 30 days by going to resourceguru.io/BOAG2017. Get 30 days for free, but at the end of that period, if you decide you like it and want to keep using it, use the coupon code BOAG2017 and you'll get 20% off the life of using the product, which I think is a really good deal. So there you go.
I'm so tempted to kind of double up on your words then, because we're in the same room.
What do you mean double up on my words?
I was thinking, right, so I was going to go and use the coupon code, but I wouldn't have done because I can't say coupon. Coupon code BOAG2017 when you're ready.
Oh, we were going to say it together. We were pros. No, that didn't work,
well,
did
more
it?
More like little children.
Yes, childish, immature children.
I didn't, but then I did.
Right. Let's talk about our next talk.
Yes.
I have to be really nice about this one because this is one of my clients. Right. So we're about to hear the best talk you've ever heard. Ever.
Ever.
No.
I'm sure I've met Andrew.
Andrew Miller is... that reminds me. I didn't say a bit about Chris and who Chris is.
Say a bit about Chris.
I'll say a bit about Chris. See, this is why I'm not professional. You could edit this back into the proper place, couldn't you?
I can if you want me to.
But will you?
Maybe.
Okay. So Chris is a freelancer UXer who's been designing websites, apps, and other exciting digital gubbins for over 7 years.
What a lovely word.
I know. We need more gubbins in our society. He works on all kinds of teams across all flavours of projects, from enterprise systems for big old companies like Tesco's and Unilever, to apps and teeny startups, which is really cool. So he's got a really good mix of people. If you want to know where you can find out more about him, you can go to justuxdesign.com. Right, back to Andrew. Whoop.
That was me. Us coming back again.
So I'm going to say about who Andrew is now rather than at the end of his talk when inevitably I'll forget.
Good idea.
That's a good idea. So Andrew is working currently for the University of Dundee. He's been working in higher education for almost 14 years in a variety of roles from design to development. He now heads up a team of 15 delivering to the University of Dundee's web transformation project, which is why I'm working with him. And he's doing very well. He gets my gold star
Does
of
he
approval.
Really?
He'll be pleased with that.
Yes, I bet he'll love
that. I'm going to get fired. So he's going to do a great talk, actually, about entitled Don't Panic, which is about the pressure that our industry has and how it affects us mentally and physically. So it's a bit of a different tangent, a really important subject. So over to Andrew.
Hi, my name is Andrew Miller and I'm Head of Web Services at the University of Dundee, and I suffer from panic attacks. It's been almost 12 years since my first panic attack, and I've been suffering from them and their associated effects off and on ever since then. Stress and its problems are not widely discussed in the community, and we almost think it's a sign of weakness, but I wanted to speak out about my struggle in the hope that it might also help others. They're the funniest of things. You can be sitting there fine 1 minute and the next, wham. Your breathing's getting laboured, your palms are getting sweaty, you're feeling lightheaded, and all you really want to do is get as far away from your current location as possible. That's not always an easy thing, especially when you're sitting in a meeting trying desperately to make it look like you're in control and you know what you're talking about. I've been in that situation a few times now. Sometimes it comes during times of actual stress. Sometimes it comes when you think you're perfectly okay. I used to think I was alone in my suffering and that my body was somehow strange in how it worked. In reality, it's perfectly natural, and it's your body reacting to the stress that's round about you. In the beginning, I felt isolated and alone in dealing with it and unable to talk openly about it. However, the more I talk to people about it, the more I discover that it's a relatively common thing, and especially in the digital industries. I've never been a terribly confident individual. I'm naturally an introvert and feel uncomfortable dealing with lots of people. I'm always plagued with doubts about whether I'm good at my job or not, and constantly in fear that one of these days I'm going to be found out. Then I'll get fired, I'll lose my house, end up in the streets, trying to scavenge enough food from dustbins to feed my wife and two kids. In reality, it's a crazy thought. The university has policy after policy aimed at trying to ensure people don't get fired, and I have a good enough support network around me to ensure that I at least have a roof over my family's head if push comes to shove. But that doesn't stop me entertaining the thoughts every now and again. There are lots of high-pressure professions out there that, on the face of it, are much more demanding than the digital realm. I know that, and I tell myself that, but it doesn't always help. Our industry is constantly changing. It's the very nature of it. You try and learn one thing, only to be told that it's old hat now, and you should be doing something else. There's so much choice these days that even trying to choose the right product to work with can cause untold anxiety. Even if you do the right thing, it'll get upgraded next week and you have to top up your learning again. We are a competitive and varied industry at heart, and it's one of the things I love about it. But the pressure to keep up is enormous. And then there's the problem of being in higher education. The days of it being a safe area to be in are looking ever more uncertain. Funding sources are being squeezed and institutions are increasingly looking towards digital as a silver bullet that will bring students in their droves. We're lucky in that we've seen our budgets and staffing increase, but the work then increases and takes up the slack. We do new stuff, but we can't quite get rid of the old stuff. What we really need to do is change a culture rather than just delivering a website. But that in itself causes issues because of the prevailing negativity in the industry currently. We want to change and people want to change, but it's scary. And trying to always be the positive, encouraging one, it can take its toll. It's the reason why so many people are burning out, from people at the very top of their game to those just coming into the industry. We're losing lots of really great people. It's really difficult just to keep pace, never mind try to get ahead, and heaven forbid you have any thought of becoming a thought leader in your field. And yet, we're reluctant to talk about the problems of stress and depression, even though it affects so many people. There seems to be some kind of stigma attached to it, preventing us from addressing it. I fear that if we're ever found out, people will treat us with disdain and never trust us with anything important. I'll never forget my first panic attack. I was lying in bed, about 3 a.m, having just woken up. My heart was racing, sweat was pouring off me, my arms and legs were locked straight, and I was shaking for all that it was worth. Every time I tried to control the shaking, I thought I would pass out. I also thought that night I was having a heart attack and that I wasn't going to survive the night. Needless to say, 12 years on, I didn't die that night. And even all the panic attacks I've had since then, I haven't died. I headed to the doctors the next morning to find out that I had a pulse rate of 140 at rest. That appointment kick-started months of follow-on appointments where everything from my thyroid to my heart was checked out to try and figure out what was going on. Looking back at it, the warning signs had been there. I'd woken up most mornings feeling okay, but as the day progressed, I felt like somebody was choking me. You ignore it for a while, but then your mind starts to play tricks on you, convincing you that you have some deadly illness that you'll never recover from. Despite this battery of tests, nothing conclusive came back. In the end, the only thing that the medical professionals could come up with was stress. It's a fair point, in reality. I was getting married, moving away from home and desperately trying to find a permanent job. All this meant I was facing my wedding day not knowing whether I was actually going to make it or not. I've never really recovered from that first panic attack. Not really. I've learned to cope and recognise the symptoms, but The annoying thing is, it's never the same thing twice. Just when you think you have it figured out, your body throws a curveball and you're left back at square one. So, does this mean I'm bad at my job? No. Does it mean I can't do my job? Well, no. Does it mean I can't progress in my career and do exciting things? Well, no. Because I refuse to let it. My natural instinct is to curl up in a ball, to stick to the easy things in life and keep as far from anything difficult as possible. However, I realised it's those difficult things in life that are the interesting bits. If I want to progress, I sometimes have to step out of that safe comfort zone, and I've come to discover it's rarely as bad as I thought it would be. In fact, sometimes these things could even be enjoyable. I can still deal with really difficult situations and can thrive in the thrill sometimes. I can stand up and present to an audience of hundreds and really quite enjoy it. I can think through really difficult problems and still come up with innovative solutions. Sometimes, it all gets a bit too much. I really struggle in the winter months and find it difficult to keep going. I've gotten better at reading the signs, but sometimes I push myself just that little bit too hard and it hits me hard. But I keep going and I've accepted that there will always be things that I don't know. And you know what? That's okay. If I was in an industry that stayed the same all the time, I knew everything that there was to know about that field, I would be bored out of my skull. I've also come to realise that everyone has their own struggles. No one has really figured everything out. There is no normal and there is no baseline. Everyone is winging it to a certain extent. It's the beauty of humanity. So I'm giving you the permission not to know everything. I'm giving myself the permission not to know everything and to feel that that's okay. So here's my plea to you, my challenge. If you're dealing with something similar at the moment, please don't give up. You're amazing and valuable and you've got masses to offer the community. We've just not tapped into it yet. Please don't struggle in silence. There's help available out there. Please don't be afraid to use it. It can be scary and it can be unsettling, but there are people out there who have been through it and they know what it's like and they know how to help. Look after yourself, and at the risk of sounding like some jumped up self-help book, get some exercise and eat well. Surround yourself with good people and steer clear of the toxic ones. If you can't do it in your work life, make sure you do it in your personal life. If you're someone blessed with not having to deal with these issues, please look out for those of us who are. We're not always the ones that you think are struggling. Help us and we will be your fiercest allies and greatest assets. If you can offer a word of encouragement or help, please do so and make someone's day. Let me end by saying my name is Andrew Miller and I'm surviving panic attacks.
Okay, so that was Andrew. If you want to find out more about Andrew, you can follow him on Twitter. His Twitter ID is MillerAJ and that's Miller spelled M-I-L-L-A-R and then A-J. So that's Andrew. Really good talk.
Yes, I mean,
this is my, you know, a subject I've talked a lot about in the past. I've talked about my own mental health issues with depression. I've written about it with Smashing Magazine before. Now I'm a great supporter of Geeks Mental Week, which is coming up again in October. You can get involved in that. Actually, there'll be a link in the show notes. Also. And Andy Clark, who's on next week, I think is heavily involved in organising it. So reach out to him on Twitter and his username is Malarkey. And if you want to get involved in it in any way. And great, just great talk, I thought. You're the wrong person to talk about this kind of stuff because you just drift through life, don't you, in this haze of drunkenness and
everything's great
and euphoria. Yeah, you're weird.
That's true. Every word of that was true, but
especially the drunkenness.
But I think it just I need to take on board what he was saying about people like me who don't suffer, because I don't. Noticing when others are struggling and helping them out. That's.
But you were always. I mean.
Yeah, because I've just said I'm empathetic, but I'm actually. I think I'm empathetic to people's struggles with work and all. Oh, I'm not sure if I can do this and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'm not that great when things are going badly wrong because I don't understand. It's like, you know, I don't.
I don't think that's strictly true. Okay, you didn't. When I had depression, you didn't notice till I told you, but then that's quite common because people don't tend to talk that openly about that kind of stuff. Mm. But as soon as I was, both you and Chris were massively supportive. Mm. I felt really supported by you. So you gave me everything that I needed. Not that I can really remember what that was, but, chocolate. You know, sorry?
Chocolate,
yeah. The answer to all things. Chocolate and cider.
Yeah.
Ice cream, actually. I'm a bit girl. I could, you know, that whole stereotypical Bridget Jones tub of ice cream, that's totally me.
Have you tried the new Magnum tubs?
Magnum do tubs?
Yes, they do.
Oh, my word, my life has been transformed.
They're pretty amazing. It's like got a solid chunk of, like a disc of chocolate on the
top.
You have to kind of bang your way through. And there's another one at the bottom. And it's got loads of little, you know, oh, what are they called?
I can't breathe.
A Viennetta.
Yeah.
Which are a bit like eating air.
Yeah.
It's like a kind of solid version of a Viennetta with like a really good quality vanilla ice cream and layers and layers and layers of chocolate. There you go.
Okay, so thanks for listening to this
show.
Yeah, thanks for listening to this show. I'm now off.
Just the Magnum tub, an amazing thing.
Oh, that sounds awesome. So that's really good.
Can't remember what we're talking about.
Panic attacks.
Yes.
Which is obviously a little bit different to what I experienced with depression. But I think it's just this point that I think our industry is a very... a very high-pressured industry for a couple of reasons. One is that everything's constantly changing on you, which is a huge pressure to stay up to date. But also, I think, particularly in people in Andrew's kind of case, he's gone from, you know, running a little web team that was in the basement and nobody cared about, you know, to the fact that now...
we're spending millions on you.
Yeah.
Kind of thing,
and the future of this whole institution is being built around digital and digital transformation. Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of pressure, you know, to go from those kinds of extremes. And I think more and more of us are finding ourselves in those kinds of positions. And it is really tough, you know. So, yeah, huge amount of sympathy for it. And I liked his comment, one little comment that I have really grown into is this, it's okay to say I don't know. And he made that almost as a bit of a throwaway comment. But for me, that is hugely liberating. That, you know, because of the nature of industry, you can't know everything anymore. It's impossible to be the fount of all knowledge with stuff like that. And that's okay to say. Mm. And do you know what? I've never had a problem with saying that. You know, when I said it, nobody's ever gone, "Well, you should know, damn you."
Yeah, quite. I mean, I don't have a problem with saying that because I actually don't know anything.
While I do know the majority of things there are to know.
But I liked his quote that he said, "We're all winging it."
Yeah.
Because every single person we've had on this show has all had this thing about imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
I have, you have, everybody does.
Yeah.
So we're all winging it. That's the right way of saying it. Absolutely true.
Which is really good as well. Mm. And that's what makes a season like this so good, is because, you know, all of these people are writing to me going, "Oh, I don't know whether I can do this. Do I know stuff? Is this talk all right?" And I'm like, we've been making it up. I don't know anything. You know, it's, you know, you just share what you know, and that's all you can do. And I've not had one talk where I've listened to it so far and gone, "No, I didn't learn anything from that," or even think, "No, that was wrong."
Mm.
You know, they've all been really good because we are all winging it, and so we can all learn from one another.
Exactly.
Really good. Okay. Yeah. Let's quickly talk about Full Story, our second sponsor. Do you want to press a button at that point? You look like you were going to press a button.
No, no.
You're not going to press a button. Now you've got to edit that out.
Well, I am going to press a button, but not a turny-offy button.
Okay.
So you carry on.
Okay. Is it a marking in the audio button?
No, it's a I haven't got a joke yet button.
Okay. So while Marcus is looking up a joke, let's talk about Full Story, right? So Full Story offers the next generation of analytics. In my opinion, it is the single best analytics tool I've seen. And no, they didn't write that line for me. I honestly believe that. It's absolutely brilliant. You have one small script No manual tagging, no events tagging and all that kind of stuff. You can get up and running in minutes. Now, it's got so many different things that are really cool about it, but probably the biggest differentiator from the competition is that every event, everything that happens on that website, every click, every swipe, every scroll, every piece of text is instantly indexable and searchable. So you can get at every event that's going on the website. On top of which, it has no sampling, right? So it's taking every event that's going on. It's not just, you know, a sample of the users coming to your site. It captures every single user session. There's so much more I could say about it, but we've got loads of time to talk about them, so which is really cool. For now, I would just encourage you to sign up today. You'll get a free month of Pro for free if you go to fullstory.com/Boag. And then you don't need to provide a credit card or anything up to try out for free. If you like it but can't justify the ongoing cost, that's absolutely fine. You can get 1,000 user sessions recorded every month absolutely free of charge forever. If you do like it, which I guarantee you will, and you can afford it, then you can go on and use their pro account, which I highly, highly recommend. I recommend this to pretty much every client now. So check out Full Story. All right, we come to our last talk.
Are we on schedule, Paul?
I've no idea. I have absolutely no idea how long we've been talking for.
Yeah, probably pretty good.
We're doing all right, are we?
I don't know.
It depends how long the talks are, doesn't it, really?
Yeah.
So, next one is from Artem. He's going to talk about UX wars, but just to tell you a little bit about him, he's a freelancer UX designer and consultant fighting for good products and services and trying to make people's lives a little bit better. That's what he's into and enthusiastic about. He's currently creating a site called Aliens Allowed, which I wondered whether was some comment on immigration. I don't know.
What's his surname, Paul?
Shut up. Hey, he doesn't get his surname said. Go on then.
It's Kalitsky, isn't it?
Is it Kalitsky? Yeah, it is actually. I'm so terrible at names. You make it sound so easy. Can you do all the names for me?
I'll do all the names.
So on Aliens Land, where he's talking and writing about UX wars and touching on various problems about humanity. So not at all ambitious there. So if you want to find out more about him, for now you can follow him on Twitter, and thankfully his Twitter ID is UX War rather than his full name, which is great. But he's basically sharing some basic UX philosophies and some UX tips, so take a listen.
Hello, my name is Artem Kulitsky. I'm a freelance UX designer and consultant, and I would like to talk about some basic UX philosophy and some UX tips that I use for my projects. And I hope listeners will also find this talk useful. English is not my native, as you can see, but I will try to be as clear as possible. Okay, so first I wanted to talk about UX war. Basically, this is how I approach every project, and the idea of UX war is to constantly fight for the users, for people, and for better products. There are so many clients who just say, I pay, you do, and at the same time, there are so many designers who just can't defend their ideas or do not know how to do this, and they do not fight for a better product, and do not fight for people who will be using this product. And I think this is not very good, because we as UX designers have a privilege to make people's lives better by creating good products. So we have to fight and do not just do what we are told. And at the same time, we have to educate our clients. So we need to communicate the importance of user research, user testings, and all other UX activities which can help us solve the problems of the product and the problems of users, of course. So, and most of my first time clients do not think about the users at all. So they only think about their business, which is basically good, and about various features which nobody cares about in the end, because all these features are based on the guesses. So this is why UX war war for people, for users, well, for people. Let's call them people. And against this way of thinking, like I pay you due, and oh, I couldn't do anything, I was told to do this. So keep this in mind always. And we really have the power to make the world a better place. And even if we will not make it better, we still have to try. Okay, let's go next. Everyone working on the product or service should always remember that the product or service should be useful, usable, desirable, valuable, findable, accessible, credible. And you have to validate your product by asking simple questions. Does this product solve the right problem? Is it easy to use? Is it enjoyable to use? Does this product provide business value? Can users find relevant content easily? Is this product usable by people with various abilities, I mean disabilities and varying abilities? And does this product feel trustworthy and reliable? So always keep this in mind, but I hope you all know this. Okay, next I wanted to remind you about the design principle called KISS, which is an acronym to Keep It Simple Stupid, so K-I-S-S. Try to make everything as simple as possible, but not simpler. And it is easier to make everything complicated, so it really takes time to make something simple. Do not overcomplicate things. Because the end user doesn't care how clever you are, how smart you are. They just need to solve their problems and solve them easily. At the same time, you also have to explain your ideas to your team. So try to explain these ideas or your product idea in a simple manner. Because if you can't explain your product or your idea easily, you do not understand it well enough. There is a quote by Mark Twain who said, sorry for a long letter, I didn't have time to write a short one. So the same can be applied to products, like sorry for a complicated product, we didn't have time to create a simple one. Also, I wanted to remind you about the book by Steve Crook called Don't Make Me Think. The idea is quite obvious here, but so you have to remember, do not make your users think, make everything simple. But at the same time, you should make them feel smart. It is not very easy, but still, this is our job. Okay, next. Remember, if nobody needs it, then don't build it. So do not implement features just by guess. And if you don't solve any particular problem, you're making your product worse. Probably making. And so if you or someone on your team has an idea, just ask them what problem it solves. And if there is no problem, just forget about this idea, at least for now. And also you have to, if the problem exists, you have to prove that this problem exists. So if nobody needs it, then don't build it. Okay, next, I wanted to quickly mention the right and the wrong questions during user research. So you have to listen carefully to people, and let's always call them people, not users. So, and ask the right questions. The answers to wrong questions may make you feel like you have learned something new, but you haven't. So wrong questions may sound like, would you buy this? How much would you pay? How would you design it differently? What new feature would you like most? And the right questions are, how else have you tried to solve this problem? How have you found similar products in the past? What happened last time you used this product? Please show. Also, various why questions. So try to ask the right questions and listen carefully. And if you didn't learn anything new from your user research, you probably did something wrong. Okay, next I wanted to mention a canvas which I use for various projects, and I hope you've heard about business model canvas or lean canvas, but for UX projects I use user-centered design canvas. Again, this word user, which I don't like, but still, this is a very good tool which combines user needs with business goals. Maybe the link will be in the show notes. Oh, maybe you can just find it online, but you can try it. Okay, let's go next. You always have to create hypotheses and test them. Otherwise, you're just guessing. You can create simple hypotheses like more people will click this red button, and you should indicate the metrics like percent of clicks. Or you can use a more complicated format like we believe that this feature or this change for this particular people will produce this result. And we know this is true when we see the data, some metrics, analytics data. And what is important here is that you can easily be affected, by confirmation bias, which means that you may try to prove you are right instead of just testing the hypothesis. So be careful and instead just try to know why you might be wrong. And regarding metrics and analytics, you should always remember that you never know what is successful if you can't measure it. Any opinion without the data just makes no sense. And also, we never know what may work, so always test and measure. Okay, next I wanted to speak about content and copywriting. And if you do not write yourself, just hire a good copywriter, because this is really important. Or if you write by yourself, just try to remove as many useless words as possible. And your text copy should not sound like blah, 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 blah. I guess you know that people do not read web pages and they just scan them. But this is not true when the content and text copy is really great. So you have to create a great content and text copy. Also, what is important here is to write a great unique value proposition. There are so many products and services which people do not use only because they didn't understand the UVP, unique value proposition. When they saw these products first time, and they could not understand their slogans and just forgot about them. So speak about users, speak about benefits, and do not go for useless slogans. Next, remember to always test your products on every stage as early as possible and as often as possible. And remember that you are testing the product, not people. Listen and watch carefully. What is important here is the fact that even if you think that something is really simple, it doesn't mean that people will use it the way you designed. Any designer compared to ordinary people is a super geek, and you should consider that 95% of people just cannot do what you can do. So try to make everything as simple as possible, but always test. And you should remember that every mistake that the user makes is not because they are stupid. It is because your website or app sucks. And when you watch different testing videos and just feel like, well, I can't believe people didn't see this button. But actually the problem is with you, because you have put the button somewhere where people do not look at. And also remember that UX failures count more than UX successes, and any error on your website or app may kill all the positive experience. And the last thing I wanted to include in my talk is the idea that there are so many products and so little time for people to use these products. So you should always think if your product or service is really worth the time spent on it. You need to consider that there are many other products and many other activities in people's lives. And before taking time to use your product, people have to stop doing something else. So this is really important to consider. Okay, thanks everybody for listening to my talk, and I hope it will be useful for you. Have a good day and goodbye.
I haven't got a huge amount to say on this one, simply because it was just...
It's like listening to you.
Yeah, except with a better accent. You know, he talked absolute sense from beginning to end, totally agreed with all of it.
Yeah, this is the connection with Mike Monteri.
Oh, yeah.
You're talking about there's a UX war out there.
Yes.
For fighting on behalf of the user. Well, it's a bit of a step.
Yeah, okay.
But Mike Monteri's the last talk I saw him do was basically about fascism that's going on in America at the moment.
Yeah.
And it's a designer and a developer, people in our industry, it's our responsibility to say no to companies that we're working for supporting that fascism.
Yeah, okay.
So it's kind of, it's similar. Because, you know, it's like saying the people that are going to help build the wall, for example.
Right.
Should you be doing that?
Yeah.
How do you feel about that? Is it just about the wage pay?
Yeah. This is nothing to do with his talk whatsoever.
No,
you just wanted to bring it up. Yeah, it is a good one. I remember getting asked that when I went to university, in my interview for university. So what companies wouldn't you work for? Mm. And it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because we had to ask ourselves that, Headscape did, with Love Honey.
It
was a short conversation, to be honest. But Love Honey sells sex toys. And so we had to ask ourselves, you know, were we comfortable with that?
Yeah.
And we actually were, because of the way they were positioning themselves and all the rest of it. And, it, you know, fair enough.
But we've been approached for porn sites in the past, which you just go, no.
Right, okay, I didn't even know. That never reached me. Also, didn't we have...
If it had, Paul, then we'd be doing them, right?
Yeah, I know. I'm up for doing a porn site. No, I'm not. Don't ask me to do one of them. Oil companies... Mm. Would be quite an interesting one with us, because we do so much with like the heritage sector or that kind of thing. So it is interesting.
We have worked for an oil company years ago, but sort of pre-Headscape.
Yeah, that was before Headscape.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to the talk in hand, which I don't think was anything to do with that. But I thought it was good, solid advice, asking all the right questions. He even promoted Don't Make Me Think by Steve Krug, which is required reading. If you haven't read that, you really must do. The other thing the one thing that sprung out of there, because like I was saying earlier, you know, I've yet to listen to a talk where I haven't learned anything. Even, you know, this talk, which was obviously fundamentals of UX principles, you'd think I wouldn't learn anything. But he mentioned the user-centered design canvas, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I'd been familiar with the business canvas for years, and I kind of looked at it and always was going, okay, it's quite interesting, but for the kind of work I do, it's probably not that applicable, but I do like the idea of it. So the fact that someone's created a user-centered version of it, absolutely brilliant. Love that. Really love that. So if for nothing else, not that there was a lot in your talk that was good, but that was the thing that I really learned and took away from it. So
I thought the simple questions were really good as a takeaway.
Absolutely.
And Ed showed me Dieter Ram's 10 Principles of Design the other day, which is kind of similar, but a bit more detailed and maybe a bit more aesthetics focused.
Okay.
No, not aesthetics focused. It was more product related, actually. But yeah, really another really good set of rules that you can kind of ask yourself back, is what I'm doing, does it fit all of these things?
Okay. I haven't heard of that either.
Simple questions were that, and the Dieter Rams ones are as well.
Right. That's brilliant. Maybe you could put that one that you've just said in these notes at some point.
If I don't do it right now, Paul, it'll never happen.
Yeah, but we're in the middle of a show.
Are we? Oh, yeah. We are, aren't we?
And it's your turn now. It's the exciting moment of your joke.
It's joke time.
Did you actually get one?
I did, and it's one you put into the Bike World Slack channel.
Oh, crap. That means that if it's rubbish...
So if it's rubbish...
I've got no one else to blame.
I'm on a win-win situation here.
I can blame the delivery.
I told this joke over the weekend in the pub.
All right.
And it went down the street.
Okay, good.
Wow, what a day. I just found out I'm colourblind. I had no idea. I was completely shocked. It just came out of the purple.
It's a good one. It isn't mine. I think that's, as I remember, I think that was a Bruce Lawson.
Oh, right. Yeah,
probably. Who regularly, if you want to follow a Twitter channel and get a good solid mixture of really bad dad jokes, the occasional obscenities, and lots of pictures of him in ridiculous shirts, then Bruce Lawson
is a man
for that. So there we go. Just to remind you that you can submit your own talk, because we freed up extra space by squeezing another one in each show. Mm-hmm. You can submit them by going to boag.world/season18. At the point of recording, I think we've got about 14 slots left, so there's still lots of opportunities. So please do so, and we'll be back again. Well, we won't. Marcus is on holiday.
Bye. I'll see you in 3 weeks.
But me and Andy Clark, will be back next week. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.